John chapter 8. We'll be looking this morning at verses 31 through 38 and continuing to work our way through Jesus' message that Greg read a big portion of to us so that we can understand where Jesus is going. Jesus is trying to present to us who He is, trying to drive home to us His identity, and then telling us how we ought to respond to that, the call that He makes to those who hear that message. And so that's what we're working our way through, and we're taking another chunk of that this morning. Now, whenever you read John's Gospel, has this ever bugged you the way that it once bugged me? John says, "And they believed in Him." And then he says, "But they don't believe." And then he says, "They're His disciples." And then he says, "They're not His disciples." And he says, "And they followed Him, but they're not walking with Him." Which is it? Well, John isn't playing with words. He's not messing with our minds the way we might wonder. He's helping us understand genuine faith. He's helping us to understand how is it that we actually come to faith in Christ. And that's a very important concept for us to grasp. Why is it so important? Well, discipleship is a matter of life and death. Discipleship is a matter of heaven and hell. We saw last time that many people came to Jesus after He preached His message about Himself as the great I Am. They heard that and they believed, John tells us. And we know, though, what John has already told us, that Jesus knows how fickle disciples can be. And so what Jesus does in the passage before us, and continuing on to the end of the chapter, is He's putting them to the test. Because, you see, He knows that some of them are not fully committed to Him. They're just caught up in the moment. They hear a great message, and immediately they're like, "Yeah." But He knows that that's not going to last for a lot of them. And so, to understand what Jesus requires of disciples, His disciples, we need to first break down what needs to happen in a disciple. What needs to happen inside of us? How is it that we could be a disciple, but not really a disciple? How is it that we can believe but not believe? Well, this is what has to happen. And this helps us to kind of understand faith if we break it down. First, we must understand the message. That's an important part of it. We have to be able to wrap our minds around and say, "Okay, I understand what He's talking about. This makes sense." But then we also have to find it to be true. Maybe you do understand the message, but you're like, "I don't think that's true, though." We have to first understand it, and then we have to believe that it's true. But a lot of times that's where faith stops or belief stops. It doesn't go the full distance of what is required, what Jesus requires of His disciples if He's going to call them a true disciple as opposed to a temporary or a spurious disciple. So that the third thing that must happen is that we must embrace the message with our whole being such that we never leave it. And we're going to talk about that. Let's picture it the way that the gospel writers picture it for us. You think about Jesus teaching and big crowds form. And so as Jesus is teaching, they're listening and they're thinking about this. And some of them say, "I don't get it." And they go home. The crowd gets a little bit smaller. And Jesus keeps teaching. And some of them say, "Okay, I get it, but I don't think it's true." And they go home. And the crowd gets a little bit smaller. And then at this point, picture Jesus getting up and walking and everybody following. And He continues to teach. And so they're following Him. And they hear His message. And they think, "Okay, I understand it, And I think it's true. But you know, this isn't for me. He's demanding too much. And they go home. And so what Jesus is left with is this small band who conclude, I understand his message, I believe it to be true, and I'm all in. I'm in it for the long haul. Jesus has their mind, their emotions, and their will. They don't go home. Why? Because home is where Jesus is for those disciples. Home is where Jesus is. They're home. Each of those groups can be called disciples and are called disciples because we don't know immediately which ones of this large crowd who are listening to Jesus and they're thinking, wow, this is amazing. We don't know yet. Jesus knew, but we don't. Which group they fall into. Are they genuine disciples or are they just temporary disciples? There are temporary disciples and permanent disciples. There are fickle disciples and unfailing disciples. There are true disciples and false disciples. How do we tell the difference? Well, what Jesus says here is that one group stays with him and the other doesn't. And so what he does here, when John told us in verse 30 that many came to believe in him, is that Jesus immediately puts them to the test. And he's been testing them, and he does it again. He's putting them to the test. Are you really going to stick with me on this? And so what he does, how does he put them to the test? He teaches them. He confronts them with the truth. This morning, I want us to learn what a genuine disciple is. And then I want us to consider whether we are a genuine disciple or not. And if we conclude that, well, you know, maybe I'm not, then for us to decide, are we going to be one or not? Because he calls us to do that. He calls us to really think about it and decide, okay, I don't think I'm a disciple. Now, am I going to do something with this or not? Am I going to follow Jesus or not? And if we have already decided to be a true disciple, will we determine to grow in our freedom? Because Jesus is talking here about being truly free. And are we, as disciples, those who have made that decision, and we are all in with Jesus, are we still growing? Are we committed to growing in that? Because we're going to talk about how what our slave master was, while it is no longer our slave master, it still sometimes gets us in its grip. And are we committed to gradually, continually breaking that grip? So notice then, as Jesus confronts them, first, Jesus calls disciples to abide in his truth. We're going to look at that in the first two verses, 31 and 32. Jesus calls disciples to abide in his truth. Look at verse 31. Jesus, therefore, was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Now, what is a disciple? It's actually a rather simple concept. It refers to someone who is a follower, someone who is a learner. And in that day, what would happen is you'd have a teacher, or sometimes called a rabbi, and he would teach what he understood about the law. And he would teach, this is the way of life, as I see it. And so people would hear him, and they'd say, I like some of the things he's saying, and so they would attach themselves to him, and they would follow him. They would be called a disciple. They would listen to him, and they would try to learn from him, and they were committed to him. Now, in the case of Jesus, we've already seen how disciples have attached themselves to him, but then after a while, because he keeps teaching, and keeps running people off because they're like, you know, I'm not in this for that because you're asking too much. We're going to see both today and in coming weeks that some of these people who were mentioned in verse 30 that came to believe in Him, that they will continue on as slaves of sin, that they will be indifferent to His Word, that they will be children of the devil, they'll be liars. And then at the end, as Greg Rich says, they're going to behave like a mob. And they're going to try to kill Him. When we're talking about Jesus, then a true disciple is someone who has come to understand Jesus' message. And that person has come to believe that Jesus' message is indeed the truth. And then they embrace it with their whole being. They are all in. You know, the way Jesus presents this is that you have to count the cost first. And then you have to make a resolution to be all in with Jesus, to be His 100%. Turn back to Luke chapter 14. This is a passage that, among a few other discipleship passages, that has had a huge impact on me. And I remember early days of my Christianity where I needed to come to understand this, what a disciple was. It wasn't just somebody who, well, you know, I go to church and, you know, I read my Bible. There was so much more to it than that. And there was this high cost involved. A very high cost. Luke 14, verse 26. Jesus there says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." And that's pretty black and white terms, isn't it? You don't do these things, you cannot be my disciple. You know, that'll run people off. And that's what happened. If you're not all in with Jesus, you're going to hear that. You're going to go, "Oh, I'm out of here." And a lot of them did. And so, he lays out here the high cost of discipleship. You have to renounce your entire kingdom. You have to renounce everything that means anything to you. And when he says that you have to hate, you know, your parents, your siblings, your children, yourself even, he's not, you know, giving us the, you know, permission to, you know, "Well, I hate my dad or my mother or what, you know, my sister or my brother," you know, we think that. And no, he's not giving us that. He's just using this as a picture. He's saying that the way we look at those things is we no longer look to them for happiness. We no longer look to them for a sense of meaning for ourselves. We don't look at those things as, "Okay, that's what's going to fulfill me, is this person or this thing, something about me." What you must do is completely subject those to the Lordship of Christ. And then he uses another picture here, Jesus does. Carrying your own cross. What does that mean? You know, so often we use it as, you know, "Well, I have this cross to bear," you know. And it's usually attached to somebody, right? You know, "Well, they're my cross," you know. And that's not at all what Jesus is saying here. What he's saying is that we have to die to self and we have to swear total allegiance to Jesus. The cross meant death. He says, "You need to carry your own cross." That means that, like him, you carry your cross to your death. You have to die to yourself. Now look how Jesus illustrates it. He kind of gives us a little broader illustrations. Verse 28. "For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it?" You see, counting the cost is where we get that. The idea of counting the cost. We have to do that. We don't just immediately hear Jesus and, "Oh, that sounds great, I'm in." He says, no. Before you do that, I want you to count the cost. He says, otherwise, if you don't, when he has laid a foundation and he's not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him and say, ha, this man began to build and he's not able to finish. You see, that's what's happening with these disciples. So many of them come to Jesus initially, but then after a while, they're like, you know, they turn away. They couldn't finish. They didn't count the cost beforehand. And then he gives another illustration. Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000. So you have an army twice your size coming to face you, and if you're the king, what are you going to do? Can we take them? Get your advisors, your generals? Can we do this, guys? I know you're good. Are you that good? Yeah or no? Yeah or nay? And then Jesus says, if the answer is, well, we're not that good. He says, or else while the other is still far away, this army that's coming against you, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. So what's the cost of discipleship? Everything. You give everything to Jesus. Now, am I saying that you now need to sign over your bank account to, you know, the church or some religious organization, and you just turn over your house and all that? Not necessarily. You know, the rich young ruler, that was what Jesus told him to do. He does have some people do that. But what he's asking of us, demanding of us, is that we recognize now that, you know, all my stuff and all the people in my life, including, you know, the family we have here, that they belong to Jesus. And that, yeah, if I get to keep some of my stuff, like I get to keep my house, my bank account, my job, my health, I'm only a steward of those things because they belong to Jesus. And I need to keep remembering that. These things belong to Him. I'm just a steward of them. And it completely changes your perspective if you look at it that way. What do you have to sign over? You have to sign over your entire kingdom. What Jesus is saying is that you need to kill the king of your petty kingdom and sign the whole thing over to Jesus and be part of His kingdom. That's what He's calling us to do. Who is the king of your petty little kingdom? You are. I am. He says, take up your cross. You need to die to self. And give it all over to Jesus. Sign on with Him wholeheartedly to be a servant in His kingdom. And the point He's making as we go back to John 8 is that when you become a servant in Jesus' kingdom, you stay there forever. You don't leave. True disciples don't leave. How then do we know if we're a true disciple or not? How do we know if we've done these things or not? Well, Jesus says, if you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. If we abide in his word. See, perseverance is the mark of genuine faith. Perseverance is the mark of a true disciple. You see, we follow Jesus and we don't turn back. We don't fall away. We follow him all the way to the end, regardless of the cost. As we continue in the truth, it shows that, yes, I did understand the gospel message. Yes, I found it to be true. And yes, I did embrace it with my whole heart. That's what he is calling us to. What does continuing in the truth look like? Well, Jesus answers that with two things. First, he says that you will know the truth. What does that mean? That means that you will stay in His truth, seeking to know it better and better constantly, always growing in it. It means that you obey it. You live it. You work to live it. And you hold tightly to it. You find it to be a blessing, a joy, a delight. And second, he says that the truth shall make you free. Spiritual freedom comes only through being fully committed to the truth of Jesus. Real freedom only comes to those who swear total allegiance to Jesus' kingdom. And this sounds so opposite and contrary to almost to logic. Real freedom comes only to servants in Jesus' kingdom. And he's going to develop that for us, okay? That real freedom comes only to servants in Jesus' kingdom. Now, what they should have been wondering, and I hope we're wondering, is free from what? Okay, he's going to answer that. But to do that, what he does now is shows them that real freedom comes through discipleship. Real freedom comes through discipleship. And let me say that I'm not talking about discipleship in kind of a real narrow sense of, okay, you've been a Christian for a while and you really haven't grown, and somebody comes alongside and says, hey, you know, you need discipleship, and, you know, can I disciple you? And I'm talking broader than that. I'm talking about go into all the world and make disciples. That is, leading them to Christ with the gospel and building them up, teaching them all the things that he commanded, you see. It's the broader sense of a disciple. It would be what we sometimes would call a Christian, a real Christian. Okay. So real freedom comes through discipleship. Look at verse 33. So as he talks about the truth shall make you free, they answered him, we are Abraham's offspring and have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you shall become free? And Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin, and the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. So once again, they completely miss his point, and they fixate on a sub-point, a lesser point. Their spiritual pride prevented them from realizing that they were slaves. Now, I don't think they're thinking in terms of literally being enslaved to someone. I don't think they're thinking in terms of, you know, Egypt and, you know, Greece and Babylon and, you know, all these. I mean, they've been enslaved by a lot of different people. And when Jesus was giving this, they were subservient to Rome. So I don't think that's what they're thinking of. I think they're thinking that, you know, spiritually speaking, no, we've never been a slave to anyone. They're thinking, for crying out loud, God made a covenant with Abraham, and we're of his bloodline. We're automatically safe from any spiritual danger. That's what they thought. We know they thought that as you read through the Gospels. But their slavery prevents them from seeing their slavery. They don't realize it. And so what happens is that Jesus presents sin here as something that they practice. They continually commit. And so what happens is they continue to just sink further and further into sin's grip. And what Jesus does here is he personifies, or he takes this concept of sin, which is, you know, picture sin. So what he does is he has us picture it as a person. And what person is it? It's a slave master. A cruel, hateful, and as far as we are concerned, by ourselves, seemingly all-powerful master, slave master. And what happens as we sin, we move further and further from God, and we're further and further from the help of His presence. And apart from the grace of God, there's no way that we can do anything to get back across that chasm. That's why it would take Almighty God to do that. And Jesus presents this not as a, you know, an occasional lapse, like, you know, Friday you're like, well, I just sinned for the first time this week. Not at all. I mean, we're kind of bordering on lying if we say, well, this is the first time I've sinned this morning, right? No, he presents sin in such a way that we should understand that it is continual self-centeredness, continual moral failure, and continual rebellion against God. The very God who's staring them in the face. And so Jesus' answer to them comes with penetrating insight. You see, he's saying, okay, the fact that you continue to sin, it is your practice, it proves that you are slaves of sin. How do I know that you're slaves of sin? I just have to look at your life. And I see that that's what you do. That's who you are. You're slaves of it. Because you commit sin, you prove that you are its slave. Okay, so sin is your slave master, and sin gives you a number of choices. You can sin, or you can sin, or guess what? You can sin. Those are the only choices you have apart from Christ until you are born again. And so, what's interesting is Augustine pointed out that sin is the worst form of slavery. Because you think about it, if you're a literal slave, you know, an actual person who's owned by somebody else, that you might be able to hide, you might even be able to escape, whether temporarily or forever, and get away from their cruelty, and get a respite from their cruelty. But Augustine pointed out that the reason why sin is the worst form of slavery is because even when you flee, you take your slave master with you. Why? Because sin lives right here in the heart. And you can run all you want. You can be a monk out in the wilderness, a hermit or something out in the wilderness, away from everybody. And guess what? As they all found, they brought sin with them. Because they brought the sinner with them. So Jesus is responding to their claim that, okay, we're, you know, from Abraham. And he's trying to show them that genealogy does not determine spiritual status. Spiritual kinship is what determines spiritual status. You see, you can be a child of Abraham physically, biologically, and not be a child of God. They had no moral connection to Abraham. They received his bloodline, but they did not receive his faith. And so those of us who may not be of his bloodline, Abraham's bloodline, we can be considered offspring of Abraham if we come to Christ by faith, like Abraham did. You see, there needs to be that spiritual connection, that spiritual kinship. And they didn't have that automatically. You aren't necessarily one who has the status of son just because Abraham's your father. Think here, Ishmael. Okay? Biologically, he was Abraham's son, right? But did he have status as a son? No. He was actually sent away, and that's the point Jesus is making here. A slave can be sold, it can be sent away. But not a son. A son always retains his status in the family. And Jesus said, a son, speaking generically here, a son keeps his status and he remains in the house forever. See, Jesus isn't wanting to just amass great numbers of disciples. He wants genuine disciples who will stick around. And so that's why he puts them to the test here. He doesn't want to flood his kingdom with people who've never been born again. We sometimes miss that. But what Jesus wants are disciples who actually have been born again, and they actually do commit themselves fully to Him. That's what He's looking for. And that's why He puts them to the test. And so He does two things now here in verse 36. He says, and He continues this idea of sonship. If therefore the Son, now He's not talking generically, He's talking about Himself, the Son of God. Now if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. And so he's kind of illustrating this point. He shows them, first of all, he says, okay, you need to understand that I am the Son of God in the fullest sense. Look back at verse 29. Jesus saying of the Father, He who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, what does he say? For I always do the things that are pleasing to him. Jesus proves himself to be the Son, the perfect Son, the true Son of God, and the true Son of Abraham. And that Paul will make a big deal out of that, how it's Jesus who is the seed of Abraham, and if we're going to be the seed of Abraham, the descendants of Abraham, we have to get there through Jesus, the true seed. And in second, Jesus here shows that our freedom is only possible because of Jesus' sonship. He says, and if the Son himself makes you free, you shall be free indeed. We have to come to God through Jesus as the Son. And then we will be free indeed. And I want to share something with you from commentator D.A. Carson. Very insightful here as he's trying to explain to us what Jesus is saying. He says, true freedom is not the liberty to do anything you please. Think about that. That's what we think most of the time, right? I mean, how many of us, you know, when you're not out on your own yet, we think, boy, when I'm grown up and I'm going to move out, I'm going to have my own place and my own car. As he smiles, you know, I was there. And then what do we think? And I'm going to do what I want, right? That's what we think. And Carson's saying, that isn't true freedom. And he goes on, he says, but the liberty to do what we ought. So true freedom is the liberty to do what we ought. What is that? Obeying the Word of God. What Jesus said, he always does the things that are pleasing to his Father. And so Carson is saying that, he's explaining to us what Jesus is saying, that true freedom comes in doing what we ought to do. You see, true freedom, that's why it comes through Jesus. But you can see this connection, because Jesus always does what's pleasing to his Father. And he's the only one who has ever known perfect freedom, because he was never a slave to sin. He always did what was right. He always did what his Father would be pleased by. And then Carson pulls this together and he says, it is genuine liberty because doing what we ought now pleases us. And so true freedom, in a sense, does mean we get to do what we want. Because what happens here is that we thought we were free in our own little kingdom here, and then but now Jesus is telling us, no, you were really a slave. And so when you renounce that, you kill that petty little king, and now you join Jesus' greater, more magnificent, glorious kingdom, and you're a servant in that kingdom. Now what he has done is he has changed your wanter. Okay, I made up words, but you know what I'm talking about. I want, I want, I want. Right? So it goes from, I want this and this and this, and I want these things to be this way and all that, to, I want what Jesus wants. I want to do what God wants. That's what delights me now. You see, he has changed our wanter so that now that we're in his kingdom, what we want is what he wants. And he says, okay, knock yourself out. Do what you want. Because you now want what he wants. You see, true freedom. That's what Jesus is driving at. That's where we get true freedom. We find delight in it. It's not that if you're sitting there going, yeah, that doesn't sound fun at all. Okay, then we need to rewind and go back to, you know, believing, and you need to understand the message, believe it to be true, and then embrace it, because you haven't done that yet. And that's what we have to do. And we have to come to the point where we find great delight in it. And so Jesus wraps it up here in the last two verses, teaching us that the proof is in the parentage. The proof is in the parentage. Verse 37, I know that you are Abraham's offspring, yet you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. I speak the things which I have seen with my Father. Therefore, you also do the things which you heard from your father. He says, I recognize that you are physically, biologically Abraham's descendants. I understand that. But spiritually, you are not Abraham's descendants. Why? He says, because you seek to kill me. You're proving that you have no moral connection. You have no spiritual connection to Abraham at all. You're nothing like him, night and day. Abraham received God's word. And at the end of the chapter, we see that even Abraham received the Lord. They won't do either. He says, my word doesn't even have a place in your heart. You have no room in your heart for Jesus' word. That's what he's saying when you're a slave of sin. And so he wants them to understand that we have to have room in our hearts for Jesus' word to reign. Where instead of me being on my little kingdom throne, that his word is there. Why? Because he is there. And I look to that and I say, that's what rules my heart. His word. Because it's his word. It's the word of the king. And then Jesus ties up the point about sonship here in verse 38. He says, you know, we both, you and I, we do the work of our respective fathers. We learn from our fathers. So I saw firsthand my father doing and teaching. And so I do and teach exactly what I saw him do. I got that firsthand. You, on the other hand, had your father whispering sweet nothings of hatred and murder in your ears. And you know what? You got that secondhand, because he's telling you the way it is, and you're getting it secondhand. And it's secondhand misinformation. What you're getting from your father is misinformation. Who is their real father? Well, they're slaves of sin. Take a guess. And he'll make sure they understand it in the next passage. So, for the short years of your life, you sit as king in your own kingdom, powerless to break the chains that bind you. We don't think of it that way, but Jesus peels back the curtain to show us that's how it really is. You think you're the king in your kingdom, but really, you're a slave in that kingdom. And he wants them to see that. What he wants us to do is then to kill that king, take up our cross, to go all in as a servant in Jesus' more glorious kingdom. That's when you will find true freedom. True freedom comes in obeying Jesus' word. Slavery comes through seeking your own will. You have to decide, which will it be? Well, now we come face to face with Jesus on his cross as we observe the Lord's Supper. And as we do, let every one of us consider his call on us.